Hi, welcome to Alaska Radio Reader Rambler, your monthly episode of Literary Snacks for the Mind and interviews. And this month we have an extremely special guest whom we're offering Northern hospitality to. Our guest is Kobe Coleman, a noted authority on Tennessee Williams, who comes to us from Old Miss in Mississippi. Welcome, Kobe.
Welcome, Sandy.
Well, we are so delighted to have you here as part of our celebration of Tennessee Williams Month, his 100th birthday. And I'm hoping maybe you will share with us how you happened to get enthralled with Tennessee Williams.
Well, I started out in 18th century English literature, and I found teaching Alexander Pope, John Dryden, and Jonathan Swift getting more and more difficult in the 80s, so I switched to modern American drama, and I've always loved drama. I was in a production of The Crucible in the 1950s, and ever since then, I've been smitten with it. So Ole Miss was very nice. They allowed me to change specialties and start teaching courses in the world of Tennessee Williams, modern American drama, drama of the American South, world drama. And it's been, I can't believe I get paid to do this. I would do it for free.
Well, this doesn't go to Mississippi, so they won't know that.
They won't know that. It's good.
But it's so wonderful to have a passion, and you are so knowledgeable about Tennessee Williams. And maybe you would kind of share with us some of the little tidbits, you know, or about the tours you conduct in the Delta, and a little bit about that.
Sure. It's impossible to live in Mississippi and not be aware of the Mississippi authors. And Richard Wright and Eudora Welty and William Faulkner and Tennessee Williams are four of the stars in their heaven. And when you live in Oxford, Mississippi, you're living in kind of the Tigris and Euphrates of the United States, because they have perhaps the world's greatest novelist there, William Faulkner, perhaps America's greatest playwright, Tennessee Williams, perhaps the greatest entertainer, Elvis with Tupelo in Memphis, and of course, the blues king, B.B. King. And then add to that John Grisham, who for a while was the wealthiest writer in America, and they all come within a 100-mile radius of Oxford.
Is there something in that water of those rivers, you think?
We wondered. We think part of it is the porch people, because it's hot, and before air conditioning, people sat on their porches and told stories. And I get so many students who don't think of themselves as writers, but they are. And it's because they have the incredible ability to tell family stories well. And they've told them orally. So having them tell them in terms of a written work is not as hard as one would think, because they already know the stories and they've told them many times. So this oral tradition, and we hope it's not disappearing with the coming of air conditioning and gated communities and that sort of thing. But it's a possibility that it's gradually moving elsewhere.
Well, it's interesting you said family stories, because I think back over the works of Williams that I know, and it's odd to think of them as family stories, but they are.
Yes, when we have the Clarksdale Tennis Mississippi Delta Tennessee Williams Festival every October, that's a land where he grew up. His grandfather was an Episcopal priest who was a minister at St. George's Episcopal Church in Clarksdale for 17 years, and Tennessee Williams moved there with his mother and sister when he was 4 years old and stayed there till he was eight and came back for fourth grade and went at 17 on a world tour to Europe with the Clarksdale group. So they were family to him, and it's very interesting. His grandfather would take him on parish calls, and he would be a little boy, and he would sit in the corner as these people confessed their lives to the priest. And his mother said he was like a little pitcher with big ears.
I love that
he
quote.
He took it in. He took it all in. And then he tells their stories. And the Clarksdale Libraries, there's this master's thesis. It had, when it came out, it had, it's not to be seen for 50 years, because this woman has identified everybody in the place with Clarksdale people who are still alive.
Well, you know, when you did the notes for Cat on the Hot Tin Roof, and we did it at Cyrano's, you were making that point, do you remember?
Yeah, Big Daddy's Plantation, the Wingfield House, the Blanche Couturier is a character in Clarksdale. The Clarks founded the town. All these people exist. They're real. I met the real baby doll. She just died at 97, 2 years old, 2 years ago, and I have a wonderful photograph of her when she was in middle age. She was beautiful, so one can only imagine what she looked like at 17 when Williams, as a little boy, knew her and looked up to her. He was best friends with her brother, Eddie Peacock. So
really? And of course, we know he loved and wrote about his mother all the time. Of course, the great glass menagerie, Amanda is really Edwina.
Mm-hmm.
He
loved her, but there was always a friction between the two. The mother was very,
and
at
the
times,
play explains
puritanical.
Why, right?
Yes.
The play
and it's so interesting.
Clearly.
She went to see the opening, one of the early productions in New York with Laurette Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
And she met Taylor backstage. And Laurette Taylor, who was a lovely woman, just nicely said, "Did you recognize yourself?" And she said, in what character? She did not see. Probably good thing.
Or Laura either as his sister Rose?
Well, maybe Laura would have, but I don't know if she went to see it or not. She would have been 2 years older. She was already having mental problems. And at one of the festivals, they brought a man who had dated Laura, and he looked like Salvador Dali, grotesque,
ooh,
even more grotesque than Dali. And he described a date on her, and it was not easy.
Oh, dear, oh,
so
dear.
That was before the lobotomy, which came a little bit later in life when she was out of control. She was telling stories that bothered her mother, and the stories about nuns doing things with candles at the local convent. And the mother was very upset by these stories, so she wanted to cut these stories out of her head. And of course, we have suddenly last summer where Catherine comes back from her trip to Europe with her cousin Sebastian, and she's telling a story about Sebastian's death, which is very unseemly. And the old aunt wants to cut the story out of her head because the story is about her Sebastian, her son. And for 20 years, she's gone to Europe every year with Sebastian, and he's written his book of poems. And this year, she had a stroke and he couldn't go, so he took Catherine, his cousin, instead, and it ended up in his death. So once again, the story is the story of partially of Laura and what happened to her.
And how much of his work is so autobiographical in so many ways.
Right. And the most wonderful autobiographical figure in the play is the Reverend Dakin, his grandfather, who appears as Nono in Night of the Iguana, and he's the oldest living poet. And I think when I teach elder hostels at Ole Miss, they come by regularly, and I tell them the importance of grandparents, because his grandmother and his grandfather were the two most positive figures in his life. They gave him inspiration. The grandfather accepted him for the person he was. At 95 years old, the grandfather went with him to Key West on long vacations and got out of retirement. And they were frequent figures on the beach at Key West, walking together, the grandfather and grandson. And they loved spending time together. And the grandfather preached Christianity, but it was kindness, tolerance, understanding. It was not the God of wrath and destruction and punishment. And at times that God came from his mother. You know, God will punish you for everything. So here he had the leavening. The grandparents were so warm and loving and mm-hmm. accepting. They knew what their grandson, who he was, and they accepted him for the person he was. So there they are. Gran is in a number of plays, too. She's the angel in the alcove. That's his grandmother. The grandfather's Nono. So he has wonderful portraits of them in his place for us to see. And the grandfather's, the father, C.C., was a shoe salesman at first, sold Red Goose shoes. And then when Williams was 8, he got an inside job in St. Louis, so they moved to St. Louis. And suddenly, although ministers didn't make a lot of money, when they lived in Clarksdale, they were royalty. Mm-hmm. When you're the grandson of the Episcopal priest, you're royalty. And when you go move to St. Louis and you live in tenement housing and your father's a salesman now working in the office, you're no longer royalty. You're just common people. And the father was very abusive of the children. He called Tennessee Williams Miss Nancy because he was effeminate and liked to read. Imagine having your father call you Miss Nancy.
Did the father really desert the family then?
Well, he was just always away doing he had his own life apart from the family when he
wanted. So the father in Glass Menagerie also is
yes.
real.
That's the father who fell in love with Long Distance. It's all there.
It's there.
Well, of course, the stories have been changed, but the people, all the whole background is in these characters. And a third of the plays are set in the Mississippi Delta. So we have the towns of Blue Mountain, and we have the town of Lyons, Mississippi, and in Two River County. And this is fascinating because it's like Faulkner's world. You have the world of Yachtin Potoffa, which is Faulkner's world, which is Oxford. And you have the world of Jefferson, which is, well, we have Yachtin Potoffa County is Lafayette County, and Jefferson is Oxford. Well, the same thing is true of Tennessee Williams, Mississippi Delta. You have the town of Glorious Hill, which is basically Clarksdale, and Two River County. It's not the Mississippi River. It's the Tallahatchie River and the Sunflower River. The two rivers converging in the town, and that is Tennessee Williams' world of Two River County. So, and there was a Moon Lake Casino, and there.
Oh, I love that.
Just up the road, there's a real Moon Lake Casino. You can stay over there at night. It's a bed and breakfast. And Miss Sarah Wright and her son, who run it, do not like people coming and giving tours, saying that was a former whorehouse. But upstairs, the bedrooms are so small, and I've stayed there with students when we've gone there, and we've taken over the whole upstairs, and they're constantly. These rooms are so small; they're so tiny. And I said, well, in their day, you didn't need to do very much. Like, settle in for very long. And they had drinking and gambling at Moon Lake Casino. And then the wall upstairs is a little buzzer, and they had a car parked out at the main highway, 61. And when the police were coming along, they had a buzzer system so that they had 5 minutes to get rid of all the alcohol, gambling, and whatever, and to make the place look respectable. So here in the during Prohibition, you had gambling, you had sex, and you had alcohol, all at Moon Lake Casino. So when Dr. Johnny takes, in Summer and Smoke, takes Miss Alma there, it's a real place.
Our guest is Colby Cullman. He's a professor of English at University of Mississippi and a well-known Tennessee Williams expert. Tell me, Colby, do you have a favorite Williams play? And if so...
Well, I have three favorite plays. I think the New York Times was asked the readership at the end of the 20th century to list the five greatest American plays of the century. And, of course, Streetcar was on there. And so was Arthur Miller's... Death of a Salesman, and Tony Kushner's Angels in America, and Edward Albee's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and Eugene O'Neill's Long Day's Journey into Night. Streetcar is, you cannot not like that play. It's at the top of the list, but it shares the top with Night of the Iguana, because in the character of Hannah Jelks, there are answers on how to live beyond despair. And I think Camino Real presents a kind of like an existential recipe on how to survive in a seemingly confusing, irrational, chaotic world. And there are so many answers in the play. And in a lot of Williams plays, my students say, this course is so depressing because there aren't answers. And then I immediately draw them to Night of the Iguana and Camino Real because there are answers there.
Why do you think Camino Real was Tennessee's favorite play? It's said to have been his favorite play.
Well, it seems to have archetype of, maybe you would agree, since you were all for producing the archetypes of all the characters that are found in the other plays, whether they be Camille or whether they be Lord Byron or whether they be Casanova or whether they be the all-American boy hero, Kilroy.
Yes, I do love the play. I love the play for those literary references, the beautiful language, the humor, but also now it's proven to be timely as well as timeless.
Right. And that's another reason I like it. We've been talking, Sandy and I, about the references to Gaddafi and Mubarak and Egypt and Libya. And the minute someone gets in the public square and shouts the word Hermanos and the people, brother, the people fall behind, there's rebellion. And if there's anything a tyrannical, power-controlled government doesn't want, is tyranny. So they throw out red herrings. And when I watch the news today, I often think that the Charlie Sheen stuff is a huge red herring because all the important things going on in the world, and we spend so much of the news half hour listening to Charlie Sheen. And Ole Miss does the same thing because we have this rebel flag and this bear. Our new mascot is the bear. They just got rid of the old colonel. colonel. Half the energy of the community is spent defending the colonel against the new bear mascot, which nobody likes. When we have 7% increase in tuition, we have faculty and staff being thrown off. We have more students than ever and much less money than we've ever had before. And all the important issues get thrown aside, and we have a gypsy regaining her virginity. And there's a party on the square for something that doesn't matter.
Right, when really it's about the longing for freedom of the human spirit and humanity and the importance of personal good deeds and civic disobedience for good things.
For good things, yes. And maybe that's why you and Irma last summer, I believe, you got together. Last summer you got together, and you probably had reasons why you chose this, the two of you.
Well, Irma always told me it was her favorite play as well as Tennessee's. So I'm so grateful that you came here to help us when we did do it.
Well, it's an honor and a pleasure to work with both you and Irma and the incredible cast of Camino Real. And that's on now for the next 10 days.
Well, by the time people are listening to this, it will have been in past tense. But I hope lots of people saw it because it was extraordinary.
Wonderful. And it lasts through Tennessee Williams' 100th birthday on March 26th.
Right. Although people will be able to see the Glass Menagerie, they are going to. Dick is producing it, and Bob Pond, who has a lifelong love affair with Tennessee, will be doing that in May, so people can see that. But the thing is, I want to maybe talk a little bit about Tennessee Williams' writing. He wrote every day of his life, I understand, but he also wrote short stories, he wrote screenplays, and most importantly, he wrote poetry.
Yes. The poetry I find the most difficult of all his writing.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite poem is in Night of the Iguana, and it's "How calmly did the olive branch observe the sky begin to blanch?" And it's about how nature survives and accepts death and rebirth and the whole cycle of things, and human beings can do the same thing. But a lot of the poems to me are obtuse and very difficult, which is ironic because Tennessee Williams is described as the most poetic of American playwrights. So the poetry I find in his plays rather than in his poems.
Interesting, because Irma told me she just created a production in New York called Tom's Children.
Mm-hmm.
And what she did was ask playwrights to choose a poem or lines of a poem and create a play about it. So,
well, I need to see Irma's Tom's Children. There's much to learn.
I love that title anyway. And we need to do Night of the Iguana, apparently.
I think you would enjoy it very much.
Yeah.
The thing that was a shock to me was the quality of the short stories, because they are so good.
Mm-hmm.
There's a one-volume collection of the short stories of Tennessee Williams, and they are as powerful as the plays. And many of the plays existed as short stories first, and then they were turned into plays. So that's to see that he mastered, at least from my opinion, short story and plays and screenplays.
Mm-hmm.
This last year, it's actually 2008, a director named Jodie Markle, who's primarily known as an actress, but also has one other movie, Why I Live at the P.O., a Eudora Welty movie.
Oh.
She's a Southerner, and she directed Loss of a Teardrop Diamond.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the few things he wrote just as a screenplay, and it's been around for a long time in a volume called Stopped Rocking and Other Screenplays by Tennessee Williams, so you can get it and see it. But it's now on DVD, and she's done a brilliant job with this unknown Tennessee Williams screenplay. Bryce Dallas Howard stars in it, and she's very, very good as this kind of wealthy millionaire's renegade living in the Delta, just come back from Europe and trying to please her aunt by having a coming out party in Memphis.
So she was the first actually to do this script, which was written way back when, 40s?
Way back
50s?
When, published in the 80s, and now suddenly it's been done as a movie. And I think it's not an Academy Award winning movie.
But we're seeing.
But it's a very fine movie.
Yeah. Well, how did Tennessee feel about the film versions of his work? And I don't know how much he had to do with them.
At times, he was very upset with them, but he liked people like Elia Kazan, especially certain directors he liked to work with, even though they often rewrote or helped rewrite with him his scripts.
It's a different medium.
Different medium, and they're also worried about sales. And the first version of the Glass Menagerie that came out has hope at the end. Laura is sitting on the balcony, and there's a new sunrise, and she's waiting for the next gentleman caller, which, of course, is not Tennessee Williams. And all the endings were rewritten, and some of the endings are just horrible rewrites.
Yeah, the famous movie of Cat in a Hot Tin Roof is very different from the script at the end. Yeah, it's a lot more cheerful.
And Sweet Bird was probably a tough one to sell to Hollywood.
Well, and Hollywood bought it, but notice what they have at the end of Sweet Bird of Youth. Paul Newman goes off with Heavenly in a Cadillac and takes Aunt, the old aunt, who the tyrant Boss Finley hates, and the three of them leave. No castration at the end of the play, and they go off to have a better life together.
So Hollywood wants everyone to live happily ever after.
Well, they want to sell tickets, and people don't buy a castration at the end of the movie, or Val burning up in flames when the Klan sets his body afire at the end of the play, or Sebastian being cannibalized and eaten by children. It's more than the audience, especially of the 50s, wanted to see. Very difficult thing to handle. And, of course, in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, there are two characters who are left out of the movie version, the first movie version. It's Jack Straw and Peter Okello. And they were the two old men who owned the plantation. Big Daddy didn't inherit it. He was a wandering, itinerant stud. Mm-hmm. And he came by the plantation, and they put him to work.
Well, that's part of his speech in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof.
It is, but in the movie, they don't do that. And these were two old fairies. And they were the only people who were ever happy in that big brass bed, because Big Daddy and Mama weren't, and May and Maggie and Brick aren't. And here you have the only love match in that entire play is these two offstage, long gone, gay men who left. And we don't know this, but Big Daddy's so tolerant of Brick's homosexual leanings or whatever that Brick won't acknowledge, that he could very well have been more than just working for these two men.
Well, we're going to soon find out how liberal radio is about
well,
these
you might
plots.
Have to cut. Do you cut some of these interviews?
No, I don't think they'll edit us out. But it is very fascinating, the difference, and that Tennessee was very respected for all these plays that he wrote. In fact, he wrote many more plays than his famous masterworks, some of them having various degrees of success and some of them not.
And now people are just discovering the plays after Night of the Iguana, after 1964. People thought he was a failure to 83. He died in 83. And people are rediscovering the works. A work called Not About Nightingales was rediscovered. But he wrote one of my favorite plays, probably in the top five, is called Red Devil Battery Sign. And it's been done with Anthony Hopkins in the lead. But it's not... It's not the old Tennessee Williams. It's more like the Williams of Camino Real. It's surrealistic. It's about bureaucratic power control. It's about an organization like ExxonMobil, which runs the world, and how one individualist called Just Woman Downtown tries to oppose it, and how she meets a mariachi player, and together they find love, real love, but they're not able to bring down the power control. And at the end of the play, language descends during the play to just words and utterings, guttural sounds. She joins the children of the Hollow, who are really the revolutionaries, and they're burning down the city and firing guns. And she joins the revolutionaries, and she becomes mother to Wolf and his wolf pack. And she becomes a new... It's incredible, because you think of the image of Delacroix's Lady Liberty leading the people. Well, here you have downtown woman at the end of the play joining the wolf pack and becoming the new Lady Liberty. And she says, mother of Wolf, mother of us all. That's an incredible image, and it's a powerful play.
Was this play ever done in the big circuits of theater and Broadway? Or
never made it to Broadway, no.
But it is published.
But there's a version of it you can get, and I said Anthony Hopkins, I'm wrong. It's the one who played Zorba the Greek, Anthony.
Oh, Anthony Quinn!
Quinn plays the mariachi player.
Oh, that would be fabulous.
And you can get it on DVD. So.
Oh, well, we'll have to check that out for sure.
It's worth looking at, yes.
So Tennessee Williams died really in a kind of obscurity. He was no longer loved and respected, and a lot of his later work was left undone?
Well, not obscurity, but he died at the lowest part of his reputation, I think, was at the time when he died, because 10 years earlier, in 73, he came out with his autobiography. And he started telling all for years. He told nothing. Then there was a show with Dick Cavett where he came out. And then he started, he told all in his autobiography.
Was that Memories?
It's Memoirs.
Memoirs.
Yes. And he has this, he talks about one night stands with male hookers. And people had a terrible time putting this using others for sex person with the man who wrote, "I've always depended on the kindness of strangers." But remember, he always said that he identified most with Blanche DuBois. And there's an interesting connection there between all of these things. So people were disgusted. They didn't want anything to do with him. Remember, it's not 2011. It was 2073, 83. And so they more or less just left him alone. And he died. I think his reputation was his lowest for about 10 years. And then there was another reason it was low. There was the literary executor of his estate, Maria St. Just, mm-hmm. who had the power over the plays. And she was like the dragon guarding the treasure.
They had a special relationship, though.
Oh, they did. They have a very special friendship. And that's why she was his executor. But nobody could get the rights to produce the plays.
Oh.
It was very difficult to get them.
Not as masterworks. They've been continuously produced.
Yeah, but even then it was hard to get because she was sitting on the treasure guarding it. It was difficult to get access to her. So suddenly when she died, suddenly the plays started proliferating in community theaters and everywhere. And, you know, the grandfathers went to Sewanee College, College of the South, and Tennessee Williams left everything to College of the South after the death of Rose. Until her death, the money was in trust to take care of her. College of the South got $10 million plus all the rights to the place when Rose died. And now at Sewanee, there's an annual Tennessee Williams Writers Conference every summer. All of this money is being used to promote writing. And it's kind of incredible that he's been able to do this with the money that he had. Well, suddenly people had the right to produce plays. And at one time in the middle 2005-06, there were four Tennessee Williams plays in New York, three of them on Broadway. And there, you know, there have been wonderful productions of them. James Earl Jones in a black, all black, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. The plays are just right now, you have just seen on Broadway. Which one? The one you saw?
The Milk Train Doesn't Stop Here Anymore with Olympia Dukakis.
And what did you think of that?
Oh, it was great. It was great. I liked it. Mm-hmm. I can see why it wasn't his most famous play, up in that masterworks category. But there was a lot of familiar elements to it. But because she's such an extraordinary actress, it was wonderful for that alone. And there are many productions around now. In fact, you wrote the article for Southern Register, like, because it's his 100th anniversary of his birth, there's celebrations in New York, New Orleans, France, and Anchorage.
And Anchorage. Anchorage is first, too. Anchorage
we'll start
is
with
the first
that's
one.
Lucky for us.
That's kind of nice to begin the celebrations here, yes.
Yes, and very nice to be noted in the prestigious Southern Register as well.
Well, thank you very much. So these productions are everywhere now, and it's amazing that they're selling. The interesting thing is the one you just saw, there's a movie version of it with
Milk Train,
and it's called Boom, and you can get that on DVD, and it stars Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor.
Is that right?
And most Williams scholars and fans think it's the worst movie version ever written of his play. So if you want to have a really good time and you like Tennessee Williams, invite your friends over for a party and watch this horrible movie and just laugh your guts out because it is dreadful.
Well, I have one quick question. When did the stamp come out in honor of Tennessee Williams?
In 97, I think.
So by that time, his reputation was restored.
His reputation had been restored, yeah. In the 90s, it just started growing, and now it's at an all-time high. And I think in the 90s, if you asked who was the greatest playwright of the 20th century in America, people would have thought of O'Neill, and they would have thought of Albee, and they would have thought of Arthur Miller and Tennessee Williams. And I think now the answer is Tennessee Williams from just about everybody. His plays are accessible. They're not 4.5 hours, 5 hours. And people understand them. People can get them without knowing anything about Tennessee Williams. They can enjoy Glass Menagerie or Streetcar. And people who are it's very sophisticated.
And even
too.
Camino Real.
Even Camino Real, right.
Thank you so much for joining us, Kobe, and giving us more insight about Tennessee Williams, who happens to be one of my favorite playwrights. And I think he is the greatest American playwright. Sorry, Edward, I think you're great, too. But Tennessee's my favorite. So join us again next month for another episode of Alaska Radio Reader Rambler. And this has been Sandy Harper and my co-host Dick Reichman.